your prime.
What about my prime, Nick?
Properly Howard, a podcast that reviews classic films and other pulp fiction. Today we look at the 1992 courtroom comedy, My Cousin Vinny. My Cousin Vinny stars Joe Pesci as a lawyer trying his first case in an attempt to keep Daniel LaRusso out of a southern jail. With me to discuss this, as always, is Dr. Anthony LaDon, plus special guest and legal expert Larry Barrent.
Yeah, we thought that bringing on a lawyer would be a good idea.
I feel like we should bring in an expert for every movie that we've seen, right? Like an actual werewolf when we do Teen Wolf 2.
Like for Nightmare Alley, we bring in an actual geek.
Or a baby in a jar.
So today, not just Steve and Anthony, but Anthony's friend Larry. Larry, I will start with this question. When I say the name Fred Gwynn, what comes to mind?
Herman Munster.
Yeah. All right. So for those of us who missed the Munsters, can you please explain the Munsters?
Well, the Munsters were a mid-60s TV sitcom phenomenon where I don't know what network it was on, but it was a response, I think, to the success of The Addams Family, which was a better sitcom. But Fred Gwynn was a Frankenstein's monster kind of figure who lumbered around and was sort of a goofball, well-intentioned, perfect suburban neighbor, except for the fact that he had bolts through his neck. And it was sort of the play on the general 1960s fear of non-conforming. But it was a passable sitcom, and it ran for years. And Fred Gwynn took advantage of his height. I guess he was around 6'5", and it was passable. Not nearly as good a show as The Addams Family.
Fascinating too that when a vampire and a Frankenstein's monster procreate, they create werewolves.
Yes, I hadn't thought about the biology of all of this.
That's all I think about when I think about the Munsters is the biology. I think about them constantly consummating their marriage and then creating a werewolf and thinking, is this how it is? Is this, if we go back to Teen Wolf, we can trace it to Robert De Niro as Frankenstein and pick a female vampire.
Was Elvira the Princess of Darkness, was she a vampire or she just kind of a freaky lady?
Mistress of the dark.
Yeah,
right. Okay. So she was the dark's side piece.
Well, we never saw her in daylight, and we never saw her eat, so I think the question is open.
I don't think I ever watched her in daylight. In fact, I believe I left the door locked and made sure no one could hear.
good choice.
Yeah, watching classic movies, Mom.
So for me, I didn't really have the baggage of Fred Gwynn, who plays the judge in My Cousin Vinny. Is that all you could think of when you watched Fred Gwynn in this movie, Larry?
No, actually. I thought his performance was really good. But the movie seems to take pains to try to avoid stereotyping Southerners. Mm. And Fred Gwynn struck me as a pretty solid judge. You know, he's got his, I guess it was a Harvard diploma on the wall.
It was Yale.
It was Yale? Well, okay. So maybe I'm giving him more credit than he deserves.
I want you to know that this movie is important to me, and it's important that we get that right.
Thank you. I'm willing to stand corrected. But he's a good judge. You know, I mean, he makes one serious, probably reversible error, towards the end of the trial. But otherwise, he's solid. He's not he gives the obligatory speech about, we may be, living in a small town, but, we have a sophisticated system of justice. They had to do that.
And there's a big book. It gives Vinny a big old book on the procedures of Alabama law.
Right. And in the usual stereotype, that would have been the only book on his bookshelf. And he had other books.
Now, does every state have a big book like that?
Yes, although, whether it's all encapsulated in one volume or not, I couldn't tell you. But every state has different criminal procedures.
Steve, what is your history with this movie?
I watched it a bunch. I saw it. I think I saw it when it came out. I was also looking at the judge as Herman Munster, as well as the neighbor in Pet Sematary.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
It's a storm coming. And I actually appreciate what you said, Larry, about the they definitely dip into the waters, like the toe in the water of they're in the South and there's different rules and definitely the two Utes.
Did you say Utes?
Yeah, two Utes.
What is a Ute?
Oh, excuse me, Your Honor. Two youths
have some feelings about the situation and they verbalize them. And so like, yeah, it's played very carefully. Maybe that's to the movie's benefit because then it devolves and like, they have to play it safer with the stereotypes in order to make it so that, he can win. Cause if it really leans too far into kind of like the good old boy network, then it almost seems like impossible that he would be able to get a fair trial out of it, right?
Right. I was just grateful that all the witnesses had their teeth.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe some extras in a bag.
Right, it's possible. Of course, the pains the movie took to avoid stereotyping Southerners, they sort of abandoned that idea when stereotyping people from Brooklyn.
Right, yeah.
But that's okay.
I'm going to push back on this. I think that there's quite a bit of stereotyping in this movie. I was watching the Siskel Ebert review of this movie, and Siskel makes much the same point. He says, look, the people in Alabama are not fools, and even though Vinny is kind of a novice to the law, he's not a fool either. And so there's some sort of cultural misunderstandings that happen, but it doesn't fall into these stereotypes. But I think that there's quite a few stereotypes that are being used. None of these people on the stand are the sharpest knives in the drawer. The guy who wants to fight Vinny, clearly this guy's got mental struggles. The judge, for all of his good sense, he gets fooled. He gets conned in the end. I mean, these people in Alabama are not being shown in the best light. In my mind.
No, I mean, no, and I mean, again, like I said, I think there definitely is stereotyping going on that's necessary, but it could have been, it could have certainly leaned into it a whole lot more. In fact, I found it surprising at times that they didn't really go like, yeah, okay, so they play certain characters as simple, but at the same time, they're a few of them are fairly adept at the same tokens. And yeah, then they play with the Brooklyn thing quite a bit. I mean, it's it relies heavily on stereotypes, but I don't think it's pushing the boundaries of them.
Well, it's a fish out of water comedy, right? So you should expect the differences to be exaggerated. I think you're supposed to allow for a bit of that here and there. And also the cultural differences kind of come up in the movie as well. I'll just play this clip here.
How do you cook your grits? You like them regular, creamy, or al dente?
Just regular, I guess.
Regular. Instant grits?
No self-respecting Southerner uses instant grits. I take pride in my grits.
So, Mr. Tipton, how could it take you 5 minutes to cook your grits when it takes the entire grit-eating world 20 minutes.
I don't know. I'm a fast cook, I guess.
I'm sorry, I was all the way over here. I couldn't hear you. Did you say you're a fast cook? That's it? Are we to believe that boiling water soaks into a grit faster in your kitchen than on any place on the face of the earth?
I don't know.
Well, perhaps the laws of physics cease to exist on your stove.
Pesci, one of the great yellers. just one of the best yellers ever.
It's also a terrific cross-examination.
Say more.
Well, first of all, he makes, you know, he says, wait a second, I'm all the way over here. I didn't hear you. Did you say that? Makes him repeat the statement.
Mm-hmm.
He never says, it's impossible. You could not have cooked your grits in 5 minutes. He just strikes it out to absurdity. This is actually one of the strange things that I found out is that this movie is practically beloved in the legal community. They use, that clip is used in law schools to illustrate good cross-examination technique. It actually is, but it's a very effective cross-examination. I mean, it's comical, but he doesn't accuse him of lying, has him repeat the statements that come out ridiculous, has him come to the conclusion that maybe he was wrong. You know, I'm an ex attorney because I quit the practice a number of times and then got dragged back into it, but I never went to court. So I can't say, oh yeah, this is what I would have done. But it's extremely effective. It's also, it's very entertaining. This, I mean, for me, the first half of this movie is passable. The second half of the movie, you know, around the trial, is very enjoyable.
So this is kind of a double fish out of water thing because Tomei and Pesci are strangers in a strange land because they're in Alabama. But in addition to that, Pesci is a stranger to the courtroom and a strange to the procedures and customs of the courtroom. And so even though you might not be from Brooklyn and may not immediately identify with this person, almost every person watching this movie is not a legal expert.
That's
and
right.
So you are learning legal procedure as Pesci learns legal procedure.
Yes, you've got that absolutely right. You know, obviously, for me, this movie should have been called My Cousin Vinny's Fiance, because without Marissa Tomei, I don't see that anybody's going to watch it a second time.
That's going to be the sequel.
Well,
it'll be My Cousin Vinny's Ex-Wife, let's be honest.
Yes, that's... That relationship is let's say improbable.
They enjoy each other. I'll give them that much.
Yeah, Larry, in your legal opinion, how realistic is it that a 49-year-old Joe Pesci pulls a 28-year-old Marissa Tomei in her prime?
Well, I think she was 24. So we can clearly use the twice her age.
You weren't fooled by that streak of gray hair in Tomei's wig.
That was hairdressing. I mean, that's Brooklyn hairdressing. I don't think she's trying to look older.
Oh, really? Okay.
I mean, Ralph Macchio is 7 years older than Marissa Tomei when that movie is made. Okay. And I
wouldn't imagine Pesci could get him either.
Well.
So I want to talk about this. So Larry and I were talking earlier about the fact that the original person meant for this role was Andrew Dice Clay.
Oh, wow.
And I've always kind of been fascinated by him, not because I enjoy his comedy, but because a Jewish guy who kind of puts on something of a Goomba affect. Is that fair to say?
It's fair enough to say that I didn't know Andrew Dice Clay was Jewish.
I guess Clay offended someone who was.
He had some movie that came out that absolutely bombed.
Oh, is that
Adventures
right?
Adventures of Ford Fairlane.
Right. I mean, I'm sure that Andrew Dice Clay offended whoever he needed to offend long before Ford Fairlane came out. Right. That was not enough to keep Hollywood from putting him in a movie. You know, you keep him out of the movie because he doesn't make money for you.
So to me, that would be interesting because this was kind of still the era of movie making when any kind of Mediterranean ethnicity could play any other kind of Mediterranean ethnicity. So, sometimes you had Jews playing Italian. Sometimes you had Italians playing Jews.
Sometimes Mickey Rooney plays a Chinese guy.
Well, that's a different thing altogether, I suppose. famously Arthur Fonzarelli, right?
Right.
It's like that character, although of Jewish heritage, if he's going to be the quirky but cool next door neighbor, he has to take on an Italian last name. In other words, I think at that point in time, having a for Winkler to play a Jew in that affect probably wouldn't have worked.
The relative paucity of Jewish greasers in the 1950s may have something to do with this.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I don't know about this.
That's my favorite thing I've heard on this podcast.
Billy Joel doesn't count?
No, Billy Joel doesn't count. No, you had to be a teacher. Like, I remember, growing up in the in suburbs outside of New York City, being a Jewish kid, and, realizing that, as far as, my musical heroes went, I could never aspire to black. But perhaps aspiring to Italian was within my reach.
No one ever said aspiring to Italian before you just said it just now.
I will tell you that it's because you grew up in Sebastopol, California, where no one saw Italian. We just saw people. Absolutely. I mean, I couldn't, I knew I couldn't be Smokey Robinson, but Frankie Valli was perhaps within my reach.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, all right, believable that Italian kid and Jewish kid at NYU are driving across the country together.
Yeah, you've mentioned a huge plot point for me. One of the points where I get lost, which is how in the world are two New York kids driving to UCLA via the back roads of Alabama?
this is a pre-map quest.
I would imagine that's true. There's a lot of setup in this movie, to get to the trial, which is where we want to get, which is where we have all our fun. The setup that this Yale-educated judge is going to be fooled by Vinny's story that, they know me in New York by my stage name. And he goes, I'll believe that. Where the judge is otherwise just, he's sharp as a tack on everything else. There's a lot of work that's happening to set this up. And some of the work is not believable. And it's a movie, so you have to go along with some of this. But there's an interstate highway system. You don't have to drive through the Soap and Suds or whatever it was, mm-hmm. the convenience store, which made me think it was a laundromat, but I guess they were referring to beer with the suds.
I think it was, suds is a word for beer, but I was thinking at one point Macchio says we decided to drive south because the weather would be better. It's just been my experience that the weather in Alabama is not usually better than anywhere else. Steve, tell me if there was a trope or a device or a cliche in this movie that you enjoyed.
The aforementioned stereotypes.
You loved all of them.
Yeah. I liked... I actually really enjoyed a lot of the performances. And now that's not a trope or a cliche, but I mean, even in terms of some of the stereotype, because I thought, like I said, I think it was handled a little gentler. I think they didn't want to make, if they painted the South with a super broad brush that it can be done a lot, then you don't have an intriguing back and forth. You don't have... a logical legal foil. I thought the prosecutor, his methods, his sort of like preacher style mm-hmm. approach to the jury, that was one of my favorite tropes, I guess you could say, because he just was so kind of down home and folksy, but breaking down the law in such a way and kind of like meeting them where they're at. There was just a little bit of little pageantry that went with it that I really
enjoyed. This leads right into one of my favorites. I love a movie that does a little bit of etymological research on the origin of a word.
You're the jury. It's your job to decide who's telling the truth. Truth. That's what verdict means. So word comes down from Old England and all our little old ancestors.
And all our little old
ancestors.
one of my least favorite. I mean, one of the things about this movie that I really disliked was they decided to make fun of a stutterer. That's right. Very uncomfortable.
Okay,
to have to watch.
As someone who does stutter from time to time when I get tired, I thought he had one of the funniest lines. So I'm going to play this little bit of the end of his opening arguments. The line that I love is the last line.
Thank you.
That's it. What about everything we talked about?
Well, I get a little nervous.
A little nervous.
I'm getting better.
I'm getting better. I laugh every time. Every time. Both of these lawyers are kind of learning as they go, I suppose.
Well, it's your choice. If you are accused of first degree murder, these are the choices of the attorneys that you have that you can afford.
All right. So you studied law at Georgetown, Larry. Did they not teach procedure? Like, is that a believable premise that someone like Vinny would have no clue at all what an arraignment is or disclosure or anything like that?
No. I mean, it certainly is true that law school fails to teach you a large number of the practical skills that you're going to need to practice successfully. I spent a lot of my legal career drafting contracts, and we never came up in law school. How to open up a document in Word and begin to draft a contract. We certainly read a lot of cases about contracts that failed and contracts that almost failed, but there are a lot of practical skills. I mean, the skills that that Vinny shows in cross-examination generally don't come up except maybe in an internship or, something along those lines. It's a major, major problem. You're going, when Vinny says, look, you're going to join a firm and they're going to teach you how to do these things. That's right. That's absolutely right.
my faith in our legal system is a little bit less, just a tiny bit less now.
But for me, that's one of the best things about the movie is that it makes a comic situation, out of something that's a real problem. That finding competent, affordable legal representation was a huge issue in 1992. It's a huge issue in 2024. We have not made any effort to solve it.
We haven't talked about Marissa Tomei yet very much. She wins the Best Supporting Actor for this in a female role for this, and
which seems odd, right?
I don't know. Why is that odd?
Why is she not the leading actress in this movie? Why is she a supporting act? My understanding of your, lead actor and then the supporting actor, there's a star, there's a main actor, mm-hmm. and then there's mm-hmm. another actor that kind of follows alongside. And since this is all divided by gender, then Marissa Tomei would be the supporting actress, and somewhere there must be a leading actress in this film. So my feeling is that in order to, they weren't going to give her a lead actress. Like, she didn't have a shot maybe against the lead actresses, but they wanted to acknowledge her, but they give her a supporting actress role. And so it's just a very interesting concept that really she's like the primary female, period, in this movie. Yet she's considered a supporting actress. Sure, she supports the lead, but that's not typically how the categories work, in to my understanding.
Yeah, I think there's also a question of screen time. Depending on how much the person is on screen, can they be considered supporting or not? I mean, she's in a lot of the movie. The other thing I was thinking was that it's rare for a comedy to win any Oscar.
Especially in
one of these big categories.
There had been, I think you would see comedies would get the supporting actor or actress nod. It's always seems to be, I remember Kevin Kline getting it for A Fish Called Wanda, right? It appears that the Academy doesn't really usually give a lot of attention to comedies. But if there is a performance that kind of is a standout, they will kind of put it in that supporting role. Like, so it's like, we're not going to get one of the big ones, but you know, we'll get some acknowledgement. So I kind of feel like that was in that same strategic play by the Academy.
I think she's amazing. I think she's amazing in this movie. What's I love this? Her.
You reading this book?
Yeah.
Do me a favor, okay? Don't read this book. Okay? Thank you very much.
All right. Don't you want to know why Trotter gave you his files?
I told you why already.
He has to. By law, you're entitled. It's called disclosure, you dickhead.
I would love to have a law class taught by Marissa Tomei.
You missed the best scene, you know, outside of the of her performance on the witness stand, which I could watch once a week.
Yeah,
she's happy laughing her in tears every week. Is that she should be known as having performed in the sexiest scene involving a conversation about a torque wrench.
It's their little, it's an interesting little role-playing game. They like to argue about plumbing, but not just plumbing, it's the science of plumbing that really gets them both hot.
I love when she picks up the copy of People magazine, pretending it's actually like the Sears catalog of plumbing equipment. It's so effective. And it's the only scene in the movie where the two of them show sort of a real sexual chemistry. I mean, as close as they're going to get.
Yeah.
I love that scene.
Yeah. And that's sort of really on that border. It's like, it's a little uncomfortable watching Pesci with this young woman. And
agreed.
The other thing is it's uncomfortable is just the wig, like the Pesci wig. that was really distracting the entire movie. I don't know if I can remember a more distracting wig
in the movie. Well, they have to do something to make him look different than in Goodfellas or the other movies he's typically in. Are we going to have a conversation, by the way, about the names of the characters in this movie?
Before we get there,
I don't know when you say time out, you know, we're done, and then we haven't cut.
That's kind of free flowing here, but I do want to discuss the wig a little bit more here, because it's horrendous. It's repulsive. And I'm not sure what's happening with the side of his eyes. Like, at one point I thought, does he like have his face taped up and the wig is supposed to cover the tape or something? Did that occur to either of you?
He did have kind of slanted eyes in one of his sort of profiles. So it's possible. I hadn't thought about it. Maybe I've just never seen him from that angle before, and that's how he looks.
Yeah, I went and watched Goodfellas again just to see, like, is that always the case or what is going on there?
Seeing him, and I had the same feeling, I think, back when I first saw it, which is, are they trying to make him look younger? You know, like, is he, because on one hand, it's like, it's fine if he's 49, and that would actually, you know, sort of amplify his failure and trying to turn, you know, into a lawyer late in life or whatever. But I couldn't quite tell because of the, you know, because of Marissa Tomei's age. And he was certainly spry enough to like leap oddly into the air to punch JT. Yeah. I mean, like, I don't know too many 49-year-olds that can get off a 1 foot that way. And so I couldn't tell if the wig, was, like, you kind of go through like a lot of different emotions about the wig. Like, are we supposed to just know it's a wig? You know what I mean? Like, because it's so obviously a wig. So then it's like, is that part of his thing? Is he trying to look? Is it supposed to be looking younger? Are we just supposed to just assume this is fine? I don't know.
I just assumed, and I'll take your word for it, Larry, that this was sort of style in Brooklyn in the early 90s. But I just assumed that they tried to put that streak of white in Tomei's hair to make her look older, and then gave him that black wig to try to make him look younger. Neither worked, if that was the intention.
True.
Anyway, their chemistry is off the charts, even with that major problem. And I think it probably mostly has to do with Tomei.
I agree. She was terrific in this movie. And she could have easily sunk into some kind of a, you know, a cliched lower middle class, sort of like a bimbo kind of a figure.
Yeah.
And instead, we have this feeling of somebody whose intelligence and talents have barely been explored yet.
Well, and she falls into that kind of non-traditional. The non-traditional thing is played up when she becomes the automotive expert, right?
Right. You know, the unwitting, unwilling automotive expert. But she's also got that, you know, she can combine that with that scene where she's stomping her foot on the porch and talking about the ticking of her biological clock. And it all works, and it's all one person, and it's all believable. And she's just she's a delight to watch.
Right. Well, it kind of plays a little bit with some of the like many films around this time, I think, portray these types of people in a mafia setting, right? Whether it's whether it's played seriously or for laughs. So we see, but so it's kind of it's a fun little twist in a way, especially because it is Pesci. To be playing it, and they're the side of justice, and so they get to have a little more fun with some of the tropey things. Where like, okay, like she kind of comes off like we've seen in movies like Married to the Mob and things like that. Yet she's there's much more interesting aspects to them other than just sort of this underworld. They're just trying to figure things out. So they're just actually just people and just trying their best. And I think that that's kind of a fun angle. And so we get to see the kind of the mob boss wife, but in a more nuanced way, in a way that it has more depth and has more personality and a lot more agency.
And I'm glad you brought in the mafia part of this, because I think this movie doesn't really work unless you have a history with this particular kind of culture. I kind of feel like if you are living outside of New York in the 80s and early 90s, the only actors you've seen take on this affect and put on this particular kind of performance are in gangster movies. And so, you know, it's kind of funny to see that person in this new context, but there's no suggestion that these are criminals. They just happen to work at her dad's car shop. So this was kind of a revelation to me, because most of the Italians I had seen in film up until this point were in movies that I loved, but they were basically criminals, or they're either criminals or not too bright. So that was sort of the typical. And I think that there's something about the accent that reads as not well educated, I suppose.
And hygiene plays a role.
I'm sure that it does. All right, so Larry, let's hear about the names of this movie.
You've got Vinny, who, as far as I know, is the only character in the movies who's named after both a gangster and an airport. He's Vincent LaGuardia Gambini.
That's amazing.
And I had to go online to remember, oh, it was Gambino was the mobster family. Yeah. Mona Lisa Vito, I don't think we hear her name, the full name, until later in the movie. But it's perfect. I now regret I never dated a girl named Mona Lisa. I just think it should have been part of my experience. It's too late now. Then the Jewish kid, I guess they decided that Rosen and Rothstein weren't sufficiently Jewish names, so they came up with Rothenstein, which I didn't even think was a real name. I had to go look it up there. It's not common, but it's there. I guess you know he's Jewish, and he once says the word putz.
Okay.
Otherwise, I don't think he does anything demonstrably Jewish in the movie.
I don't know about that. Like, there were a few times when he's discussing the ineptitude of Vinny early on.
He whines.
Where he's a little bit. But also, I mean, to me, he's believably Jewish. In not just in terms of like the way he's whining, but also his sense of humor.
Well, the only person in the movie that complains about the lack of Chinese food in Alabama is Marissa Tomei. I didn't even know Italians like Chinese food. This is a revelation to me. It's like I consider myself to be culturally enlightened.
That's the cleanest prison that I've ever seen in a movie.
The prison wares is top notch.
It's fantastic. Everything's white. It looks like the thing was just built like 2 days ago. And the Italians in this film love to sleep in the prison. That's really the only place that they can sleep.
That's a good joke.
I love that. I absolutely love to see a prison movie. Like I love to see like the inside the prison, what the prison culture is like. This movie does none of that. For all we know, the prison is the safest place in all of Alabama.
Well, to throw against the realism in here, defendants before a criminal trial are not generally held in a state lockdown prison.
But for murder?
Even for murder.
Really? Okay.
It's not the usual thing. There's usually a county jail. It's going to be more convenient. While we're at it, the fact that Joe Pesci initially visits the two Utes in their jail cell, that doesn't happen.
Well, you had that little misunderstanding. Poor Rothenstein feels like Pesci's there to dominate him.
That's pretty amazing.
That joke goes on a little bit too long.
Yes, it goes. It shouldn't have started. It was too long. I mean, again, that's another. You know, that and the stuttering public defender were two scenes I just grit my teeth through. I mean, oh, please. I don't have to see this again.
I kind of liked it when he said, I think you should show me a little gratitude. And Robinson says, boy, the ego on you.
All right. I'll write the dissenting opinion on that scene.
Okay. All right. Larry, was there a trope, a cliche, or a device in this movie that you enjoyed?
Oh, that's a really good question. I think actually the trope or cliche I always enjoy is when the camera will cut to the face of an affirming black character to let us know that, yes, what we just saw was something good.
Yeah, sure.
Like the camera would occasionally cut to the black bailiff in the courtroom, and if he would smile or nod his head.
The bailiff in this movie could host his own children's program.
I think so.
He's totally happy. His mustache is perfect. And he almost has like a Moonlight Graham smile. It's like when he smiles, you could almost imagine a little like ding, like twinkle in his eye.
The same thing comes up when Marissa Tomei mentions Alabama mud in her testimony. And they cut to the jury and all the black jurors are nodding up and down saying, yep, we know what you mean. It's very cliched, and it just totally works for me. For me, it's a cliched way of efficiently telling the audience, this is effective, this is landed, this is true, because the white character has gotten across something to a black character. So it must be effective communication to have gotten over the racial barrier.
Also, I think that there's, for a lot of folks, the Southern accent, you know, you're not sure that you can trust it. Like, how many times have we seen the Southern accent in a movie that is voiced by a villain? So if it is a Southern lawyer, maybe we need that additional affirmation.
Well, we've got Southern accents versus Brooklyn accents in this movie, and I think Brooklyn won. In the sense of,
I think so too.
You know, being less trustworthy, you know, more exotic, and potentially less intelligent or more ignorant, and of course, having practiced in, you know, in New York City with people who had New York accents, I know the efforts that folks went through to lose those accents that they were
going. Oh, that's interesting. I mean, I would imagine the Jewish neighborhood had a different affect than the Italian neighborhood versus the Puerto Rican narrative.
Not that different in terms of accents. Accents were accents.
But when those kids got law degrees and they walked into a courtroom, did they put on a more transatlantic or?
I know I made it. I still speak with a little bit of a New York accent. I know that when I moved to California, I made an effort to try to get rid of it. It was simply not going to serve me. I mean, unless I was trying to look, you know, to sound tough or something, which never worked, no matter what accent I used.
Steve, is there a tweak that you'd make to this movie to improve it?
I don't necessarily need to see Joe Pesci's undercarriage in the shower photo.
Oh, no? You didn't like that?
Less is more in this case.
Larry, was there a tweak you would make to this movie to improve it?
It's the fact that this movie works for me is so improbable that I'm afraid any kind of tweak that I would do, you know, might spoil the magic. I mean, we complain about Joe Pesci and being 49, but he's able to pull off being both the best and the worst lawyer you've ever seen, you know, in the same movie, sometimes in the same scene. I don't know anybody else who could have done it.
You're not a fan of legal dramas.
You know, the American Bar Association actually has a list online of the best legal drama movies ever.
Okay.
This movie came in number 3.
Do you remember what 1 and 2? Just out of curiosity.
Number 1 is To Kill a Mockingbird.
Of course, yeah.
And number 2 is 12 Angry Men.
Okay, all right.
To be
not Jury Duty with Pauly Shore, or is that like...
I don't think it made any of those lists. To be number 3 on this list is to be like saying, okay, you're the third greatest, you know, heavyweight after Muhammad Ali or, you know, Rocky Marciano. I mean, it's you might as well be number 1. This movie is like a favorite. This movie is cited by Merrick Garland. You know, he talks about it. I mean, there are a lot of things in this movie that I would probably change and make it worse.
You'd probably get rid of the implied sodomy and stuttering, right?
Yes.
Or at least put those both in the same scene.
Yeah.
Well, and make the scene shorter and then cut it out of the movie altogether. Those would be great changes. But, you know, again, I look at, you know, the poor Ralph Macchio, who is at 31, has to still play some kind of, you know, beardless college student, who disappears from the movie really after, you know, 10 minutes in.
All right, a little fun fact about me is that when I was in 8th grade, I had that exact haircut, and I looked a little bit like Ralph Macchio. And
I would insist on photographic evidence.
All right, I can provide. Now I should let you know that at the same time, across town, my wife Sarah had a crush on Ralph Macchio. Mm. Now I look much more like Joe Pesci, and my wife never had a crush on Joe Pesci.
She hasn't grown into it.
Nope. All right. Now, I know you don't want to talk about this, but I feel like I ought to mention it. So I went to a top 50 legal dramas of all time list.
Oh, no. What did you find?
I found that all 50, and I'm not going to name them because that would take forever, not one Jewish main character. If you think of these major movies, like The Verdict or A Few Good Men, or, you know, these sort of these very, very celebrated legal dramas, the lawyers are never Jewish. At least the sort of the head litigator or the trial lawyer or the person who has the most screen time, never given to a Jewish
Cruz character. Versus Kevin Pollak.
Yeah, right. So Kevin Pollak is easily the third wheel, right? You've got Tom Cruise and then Demi Moore and then Kevin Pollak, right?
I'll mention one.
All right. I was hoping you'd
But you'd know almost him. Have to you'd almost have to have read the book. It's The Caine Mutiny.
Okay.
The attorney that defends Steve Merrick against the mutiny charges is Jewish, and in the book, after winning the trial, shows up drunk at the victory party, and talks about how the Captain Queegs were the people who saved his Jewish relatives from Hitler.
Oh, interesting.
In the movie, the character is played by Jose Ferrer. Going back to the Jewish character not being played mm-hmm. by a Jewish actor, but I'm never going to object to Jose Ferrer, playing a linesman. It's only going to make us look better.
Never seen it. I probably should.
It's one of the better legal dramas, although I don't know if it necessarily makes the lists. The military legal dramas, some of them are on the list, A Few Good Men, things like
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right, and I, honestly can't help but think that's a conscious choice to try to avoid a cliche or a perception. They're trying to make the lawyer more sympathetic.
It's weird because there's just so few Jews in Hollywood, right?
Yeah, have you thought about trying to get more Jews in the media to fix this problem?
there's one of those great questions that no matter how I answer that, it would be dangerous. And so I'm going to just pretend I didn't hear that.
That's right. We are the world's most dangerous podcast.
I mean, this movie, you could probably forgive it, but, list of top 50 movies and it's hard to find a Jewish main character. I mean, it definitely struck me as odd. Steve, yeah. Is this movie better, worse, or on par with a Ron Howard film?
I think it's a Ron Howard plus two.
Now, just to remind our listeners and Larry, because he hasn't taken place in this process before, the acknowledgement here is that Ron Howard makes good films. So if it's properly Howard, it means it's a good movie. It doesn't mean that all Ron Howard movies are just good. Like some are great, some are not so great, but he's dependably a good movie maker, and that's kind of the premise to this. So Ron Howard plus what'd you say?
Two.
Plus two. Interesting. Tell me why.
I on one hand, I think that there's a lot of this movie that Ron Howard could have done like similarly. I mean obviously there's a good enough script in terms of the legal side of it to have it rank high amongst legal professionals opinions, but I think the performances are really good, and I think there's something to be said for that maybe. I mean, I think Ron Howard does, like I think we've talked about before, is that it feels like Ron Howard doesn't always maybe get the most out of his like the star-studded cast, and this isn't necessarily star-studded, but the stars are amazing, and the supporting roles are so strong, and I almost wonder if a director with maybe a little less foot on the gas and letting the actors really chew it up is maybe why I maybe put up a little bit higher. I mean the pool and chicken bar, for example, shot on location. The only actor in that scene is the one who he's arguing with, JT.
The guy with the neck brace isn't an actor?
They're all, everybody else is locals. And
I
even
totally
the guy
believe
that
guy was wearing a neck brace.
Even the guy that sucks the chicken right off the bone. In fact,
my hero.
He basically demonstrated his ability to do that to the director, and the director's like, "Yep," and made it a prominent scene in there.
Showed a little initiative.
So I'm not saying that Ron Howard wouldn't. I'm just
God
saying,
bless him.
I'm not saying that Ron Howard wouldn't let the guy suck the chicken right off the bone, but I haven't seen it in a Howard movie before, so. I'm giving an extra two bumps for the chicken scene.
This was a little bit slapsticky, this movie. Not all the time. But you know, there were a few scenes like the, you know, any scene involving mud. Really laughed hard when the owl hoots and he runs outside just haphazardly shooting at everything and nothing. I laughed hard at that. I don't think Ron Howard really does slapstick. At least he's not known for doing that. What do you think, Larry? You want to play along? You want to play along with the Howard scare? All right.
I'll play along. I can't think off the top of my head of a Ron Howard comedy.
Probably Parenthood would be his sort of most celebrated comedy.
Okay. Night Shift.
Oh, Night Shift was his. Okay. I do think there was something spontaneous about this film. Yeah, Steve, I agree with you that some of these elements were found. The business about the two Utes. Evidently, this was something that Joe Pesci said to the director in a conversation, and the director didn't understand what he meant. and then said, "Okay, we have to include that in the movie." I shouldn't say this. I don't know Ron Howard. I don't know his work that well. It doesn't strike me as something he would do. He seems so earnest.
Mm.
I would say, you know, Ron Howard plus one.
All right, I like it. I'm going to agree with Larry on this. Ron Howard plus one. I do like this movie. I think it's kind of quirky. I don't really know anything about the law, so I can't really appreciate it on that level. But I laugh every time I watch it. And I think this is pretty close to a Ron Howard comedy, for, you know, comparing the two we just mentioned. So I'm going to give it a Howard plus one. Now, I will mention, while we're talking about this, I just recently watched a Ron Howard documentary on Jim Henson. Have either of you seen this?
No.
It's pretty good. Ron Howard's done a few documentaries in recent years, and they're not my favorite, but this one in particular, I learned a lot about Jim Henson that I had no idea about. Very much worth watching if you are at all interested in the Muppets or, you know, history of that era of TV. Steve, is there a half the battle, one de Gron moment in this movie?
Well, my biggest takeaway, and I haven't had a chance to really put it into practice yet, but it's try dipping your corn in beans.
You've never done that, huh?
He just went right to it. Like, here's the thing. You talk about a fish out of water thing, and I don't know much about Italian culture. But he just takes that corn cob with such confidence and just rolls it in the beans as he's eating it. And I'm like, I got a lot to think about that one.
All right. Was there a moral of the story to this movie, Larry?
It would have something to do with classic cars, though, wouldn't it? I mean, we haven't talked at all, you know, about the limited slip differential and the positive traction, you know, and the improbability of two early 1960s, you know, mm-hmm. classic cars.
Sure.
The moral of the story, I think, is that they should bring back metallic mint green cars.
Yeah.
I would totally buy a metallic mint green car. I'd like to buy a Hyundai Ioniq 5 in metallic mint green.
Love that.
That may not be everybody's moral to the story.
All right. I got to ask, have either of you ever owned a convertible?
No.
Yeah. Does that appeal to you?
It's like one of those things that I'd probably love to own a convertible, and I would probably never take the top down.
Yeah, you know, that's me.
It's too inconvenient. Oh, I'm going to get a sunburn. I forgot to put on the sunblock. I absolutely would love to have owned a convertible and then would have felt guilty for the rest of my life that I basically drove it with the top up.
So when I was in my early 20s, I owned a Celica. And it was sort of like a early 80s Celica. And it had a sunroom. It actually had a moonroof, right? It's sort of like the more depressing version of the sunroof, you know, because it just kind of popped up 2 inches, served no purpose at all. So I decided that I was going to get smart, and I was going to take it off at the hinges so that I could like take off the glass and just put the glass in the back, and it would be a legit sunroof, which worked well for about a week. And then when I put it back on,
no usable servable parts inside.
When I put it back on, I didn't put it back on well enough, and it flipped off and shattered on the freeway. And I think that Margaret Ann Silver was in the car, Steve. And she kind of freaked out, which, you know, as she should. And I kind of played it off like, that's fine.
Yeah, yeah. Celicas be like that sometimes.
All right, I'm going to play you one more little thing just because it's one of my favorite scenes in any movie ever. And I don't know if I'm going to get a chance to play it another time.
And there was this man. He would never talk. He would just sit there all night, not say a word. So they says to him, what's the matter, compadre? Don't you talk? Don't you say anything? He says, what am I going to say? That my wife two times me? So she says to him, shut up, you're always talking. But in Italian, it sounds much nicer. Well, you know,
the content.
Yeah, that's it.
What's that mean?
Canudo means he's content to be a jerk. Well, and he doesn't care who knows it. He's
did Tommy ever tell you about my painting?
No.
She's got the painting ready under the table.
Look at this.
That's beautiful.
I like this one. One dog goes one way and the other dog goes the other way.
One is going east and the other one is going west. So what?
And this guy's saying, what do you want from me? This guy's got a nice head of white hair. Look how beautiful.
This summer, we enter a new era of Star Wars.
You mean the Dawn of the Star Wars Canon Timeline podcast?
Yeah, sure, that too. But I was obviously talking about The Acolyte. We've got to cover that on the Lorehounds.
Oh, but the Star Wars Canon Timeline podcast is exactly at that point in the timeline, the end of the High Republic, 100 years before the prequel trilogy. We've got to cover it there.
Why not both?
Okay, deal.
It's the first live-action Star Wars outside the Skywalker saga. Nobody can miss this.
Listeners, kick off your hot lore summer weekends with scene-by-scene breakdowns of The Acolyte, found in both the Star Wars Canon Timeline podcast and the Lorehounds Mother Feed.
And the Lorehounds Star Wars Feed.
Wherever you like to listen, a couple of days after each new episode is released.